Chapter 13. An ant, and obliged to tie it round his face, and go out of his warm harem at midnight at the cursed cry of Anenvar. We saw his highness in the midst of his people and their petitions, when he came to the Muscatapana, not the largest, but one of the most picturesque of the public buildings of the city. The streets were crowded with people watching for the august arrival, and lined with the squat military in their bastard European costume, the sturdy police, with bandoliers and brown surtouts, keeping order, driving off the faithful from the railings of the esplanade through which their emperor was to pass, and only admitting, with a very unjust partiality, I thought, us Europeans into that reserved space. Before the august arrival, numerous officers collected, colonels and pashas went by with their attendant running footmen, the most active, insolent, and hideous of these great men, as I thought, being his highness's black eunuchs, who went prancing through the crowd, which separated before them with every sign of respect. The common women were assembled by many hundreds. The yakmak, a muslin chin cloth which they wear, makes almost every face look the same, but the eyes and noses of these beauties are generally visible, and, for the most part, both these features are good. The jolly negresses wear the same white veil, but they are by no means so particular about hiding the charms of their good-natured black faces, and they let the cloth blow about as it lists, and grin unconfined. Wherever we went, the Negroes seemed happy. They have the organ of child-loving. Little creatures were always prattling on their shoulders, queer little things in nightgowns of yellow dimity, with great flowers, and pink or red or yellow shawls, with great eyes glistening underneath. Of such, the black women seemed always the happy guardians. I saw one at a fountain, holding one child in her arms, and giving another a drink, a ragged little beggar a sweet and touching picture of a black charity. I am almost forgetting His Highness the Sultan. About 100 guns were fired off at clumsy intervals from the esplanade facing the Bosphorus, warning us that the monarch had set off from his summer palace, and was on the way to his grand canoe. At last that vessel made its appearance. The band struck up his favorite air, his caparisoned horse was led down to the shore to receive him, the eunuchs, fat pashas, colonels, and officers of state gathering round as the commander of the faithful mounted. I had the indescribable happiness of seeing him at a very short distance. The Padishah, or father of all the sovereigns on earth, has not that majestic air which some sovereigns possess, and which makes the beholder's eyes wink, and his knees tremble under him. He has a black beard, and a handsome well-bred face, of a French cast. He looks like a young French roué worn out by debauch, his eyes bright, with black rings round them, his cheeks pale and hollow. He was lolling on his horse, as if he could hardly hold himself on the saddle, or as if his cloak, fastened with a blazing diamond clasp on his breast, and falling over his horse's tail, pulled him back. But the handsome sallow face of the refuge of the world looked decidedly interesting and intellectual. I have seen many a young Don Juan at Paris, behind a counter, with such a beard and countenance, the flame of passion still burning in his hollow eyes, while on his damp brow was stamped the fatal mark of premature decay. The man we saw cannot live many summers. Women and wine are said to have brought the Zalola to this state, and it is whispered by the dragomans, or lack waste a place, from whom travelers at Constantinople generally get their political information, that the Sultan's mother and his ministers conspire to keep him plunged in sensuality, that they may govern the kingdom according to their own fancies. Mr. Urquhart, I am sure, thinks that Lord Palmerston has something to do with the business, and drugs the Sultan's champagne for the benefit of Russia. As the Pontiff of Mussulmans passed into the mosques, a shower of petitions was flung from the steps, where the crowd was collected, and over the heads of the gendarmes in brown. A general cry, as for justice, rose up. And one old ragged woman came forward, and burst through the throng, howling, and flinging about her lean arms, and baring her old shrunken breast. I never saw a finer action of tragic woo, or heard sounds more pitiful than those old passionate groans of hers. What was your prayer, poor old wretched soul? The gendarmes hemmed her round, and hustled her away, but rather kindly. The Padisha went on quite impassable, the picture of debauch and ennui. I like pointing morals, and inventing for myself cheap consolations, to reconcile me to that state of life into which it has pleased heaven to call me, and as the light of the world disappeared round the corner, I reasoned pleasantly with myself about His Highness, and enjoyed that secret selfish satisfaction a man has, who sees he is better off than his neighbor. Michelangelo, I said, you are still, by courtesy, young. If you had 500,000 a year, and were a great prince, I would lay a wager that men would discover in you a magnificent courtesy of demeanor, and a majestic presence that only belongs to the sovereigns of the world. If you had such an income, you think you could spend it with splendor, distributing genial hospitalities, kindly alms, soothing misery, bidding humility be of good heart, rewarding desert. If you had such means of purchasing pleasure, you think, you rogue, you could relish it with gusto. But fancy being brought to the condition of the poor light of the universe yonder, and reconcile yourself with the idea that you are only a farthing rushlight. The cries of the poor widow fall as dead upon him as the smiles of the brightest eyes out of Georgia. He can't stir abroad, but those abominable cannon begin roaring and deafening his ears. He can't see the world, but over the shoulders of a row of fat pashas and eunuchs, with their infernal ugliness. His ears can never be regaled with a word of truth, or blessed with an honest laugh. The only privilege of manhood left to him, he enjoys but for a month in the year, at this time of Ramadan, when he is forced to fast for 15 hours, and, by consequence, has the blessing of feeling hungry. Sunset during Lent appears to be his single moment of pleasure. They say the poor fellow is ravenous by that time, and as the gun fires the dish covers are taken off, so that for 5 minutes a day he lives, and is happy over pillow, like another mortal. And yet, when floating by the summer palace, a barbaric edifice of wood and marble, with gilded suns blazing over the porticos, and all sorts of strange ornaments and trophies figuring on the gates and railings, when we passed a long row of barred and filigreed windows, looking on the water when we were told that those were the apartments of His Highness's ladies, and actually heard them whispering and laughing behind the bars, a strange feeling of curiosity came over some ill-regulated minds, just to have one peep, one look at all those wondrous beauties, singing to the dulcimers, paddling in the fountains, dancing in the marble halls, or lolling on the golden cushions, as the gaudy black slaves brought pipes and coffee. This tumultuous movement was calmed by thinking of that dreadful statement of travelers, that in one of the most elegant halls there is a trapdoor, on peeping below which you may see the Bosphorus running underneath, into which some luckless beauty is plunged occasionally, and the trapdoor is shut, and the dancing and the singing, and the smoking, and the laughing go on as before. They say it is death to pick up any of the sacks thereabouts, if a stray one should float by you. There were none any day when I passed, at least, on the surface of the water. It has been rather a fashion of our travelers to apologize for Turkish life, of late, and paint glowing agreeable pictures of many of its institutions. The celebrated author of Palm Leaves, his name is famous under the date trees of the Nile, and uttered with respect beneath the tents of the Bedouin, has touchingly described Ibrahim Pasha's paternal fondness, who cut off a black slave's head for having dropped and maimed one of his children, and has penned a melodious panegyric of the harem, and of the fond and beautiful duties of the inmates of that place of love, obedience, and seclusion. I saw, at the mausoleum of the late Sultan Mahmud's family, a good subject for a ghazal, in the true New Oriental manner. These royal burial places are the resort of the pious Muslims. Lamps are kept burning there, and in the anticammers, copies of the Quran are provided for the use of believers. and you never pass these cemeteries, but you see Turks washing at the cisterns, previous to entering for prayer, or squatted on the benches, chanting passages from the sacred volume. Christians, I believe, are not admitted, but may look through the bars, and see the coffins of the defunct monarchs, and children of the royal race. Each lies in his narrow sarcophagus, which is commonly flanked by huge candles, and covered with a rich embroidered pall. At the head of each coffin rises a slab, with a gilded inscription. For the princesses, the slab is simple, not unlike our own monumental stones. The headstones of the tombs of the defunct princes are decorated with a turban, or, since the introduction of the latter article of dress, with the red fez. That of Mahmud is decorated with the imperial aigrette. In this dismal but splendid museum, I remark two little tombs with little red fezes, very small, and four very young heads evidently, which were lying under the little embroidered palls of state. I forget whether they had candles too, but their little flame of life was soon extinguished, and there was no need of many pounds of wax to typify it. These were the tombs of Mahmud's grandsons, nephews of the present light of the universe, and children of his sister, the wife of Halil Pasha. Little children die in all ways. These of the much maligned Mahometan royal race perished by the bowstring. Sultan Mahmud, may he rest in glory, strangled the one, but, having some spark of human feeling, was so moved by the wretchedness and agony of the poor bereaved mother, his daughter, that his royal heart relented towards her, and he promised that, should she ever have another child, it should be allowed to live. He died, and Abdul-Majid, may his name be blessed, the debauched young man whom we just saw riding to the mosque, succeeded. His sister, whom he is said to have loved, became again a mother, and had a son. But she relied upon her father's word and her august brother's love, and hoped that this little one should be spared. The same accursed hand tore this infant out of its mother's bosom, and killed it. The poor woman's heart broke outright at this second calamity, and she died. But on her deathbed she sent for her brother, rebuked him as a perjurer and an assassin, and expired calling down the divine justice on his head. She lies now by the side of the two little fezes. Now I say this would be a fine subject for an oriental poem. The details are dramatic and noble, and could be grandly touched by a fine artist. If the mother had borne a daughter, the child would have been safe. That perplexity might be pathetically depicted as agitating the bosom of the young wife about to become a mother. A son is born. You can see her despair and the pitiful look she casts on the child, and the way in which she hugs it every time the curtains of her door are removed. The Sultan hesitated probably. He allowed the infant to live for 6 weeks. He could not bring his royal soul to inflict pain. He yields at last. He is a martyr to be pitied, not to be blamed. If he melts at his daughter's agony, he is a man and a father. There are men and fathers too in the much maligned Orient. Then comes the second act of the tragedy. The new hopes, the fond yearnings, the terrified misgivings, the timid belief, and weak confidence. The child that is born, and dies smiling prettily, and the mother's heart is rent so, that it can love, or hope, or suffer no more. Allah's God. She sleeps by the little fezes. Hark, the guns are booming over the water, and His Highness is coming from his prayers. After the murder of that little child, it seems to me one can never look with anything but horror upon the butcherly Herod who ordered it. The death of the 70,000 Janissaries ascends to historic dignity, and takes rank as war. But a great prince and light of the universe, who procures abortions and throttles little babies, dwindles away into such a frightful insignificance of crime, that those may respect him who will. I pity their excellencies the ambassadors, who are obliged to smirk, and cringe to such a rascal. To do the Turks justice and 2 days' walk in Constantinople will settle this fact as well as a year's residence in the city. The people do not seem in the least animated by this Herodian spirit. I never saw more kindness to children than among all classes. More fathers walking about with little solemn Mahometans in red caps and big trousers. More business going on than in the toy quarter and in the Yatmaden. Although you may see there the Thebaic stone set up by the Emperor Theodosius, and the bronze column of serpents which Murray says was brought from Delphi, but which my guide informed me was the very one exhibited by Moses in the wilderness, yet I found the examination of these antiquities much less pleasant than to look at the many troops of children assembled on the plain to play, and to watch them as they were dragged about in little queer robas, or painted carriages, which are there kept for hire. I have a picture of one of them now in my eyes. A little green oval machine, with flowers rudely painted round the window, out of which two smiling heads are peeping, the pictures of happiness. An old, good-humored, gray-bearded Turk is tugging the cart, and behind it walks a lady in a yakmak and yellow slippers, and a black female slave, grinning as usual, towards whom the little coach riders are looking. A small sturdy barefooted Muslim is examining the cart with some feelings of envy. He is too poor to purchase a ride for himself, and the round-faced puppy dog, which he is hugging in his arms as young ladies in our country do dolls. All the neighborhood of the Yatmaden is exceedingly picturesque. The mosque, court and cloister, where the Persians have their stalls of sweetmeats and tobacco. A superb sycamore tree grows in the middle of this, overshadowing an aromatic fountain. Great flocks of pigeons are settling in corners of the cloister, and barley is sold at the gates, with which the good-natured people feed them. From the Yatmaden you have a fine view of St. Sophia. And here stands a mosque which struck me as being much more picturesque and sumptuous, the mosque of Sultan Achmed, with its six gleaming white minarets and its beautiful courts and trees. Any infidels may enter the court without molestation, and, looking through the barred windows of the mosque, have a view of its airy and spacious interior. A small audience of women was collected there when I looked in, squatted on the mats, and listening to a preacher, who was walking among them, and speaking with great energy. My dragoman interpreted to me the sense of a few words of his sermon. He was warning them of the danger of gadding about to public places, and of the immorality of too much talking, and, I dare say, we might have had more valuable information from him regarding the follies of womankind, had not a tall Turk clapped my interpreter on the shoulder, and pointed him to be off. Although the ladies are veiled, and muffled with the ugliest dresses in the world, yet it appears their modesty is alarmed in spite of all the coverings which they wear. One day, in the bazaar, a fat old body, with diamond rings on her fingers, that were tinged with henna of a logwood color, came to the shop, where I was purchasing slippers, with her son, a young aga of 6 years of age, dressed in a braided frock coat, with a huge tassel to his fez, exceeding fat, and of a most solemn demeanor. The young aga came for a pair of shoes, and his contortions were so delightful as he tried them, that I remained looking on with great pleasure, wishing for Leech to be at hand, to sketch his lordship and his fat mama, who sat on the counter. That lady fancied I was looking at her, though, as far as I could see, as he had the figure and complexion of a roly-poly pudding, and so, with quite a premature bashfulness, she sent me a message by the shoemaker, ordering me to walk away, if I had made my purchases, for that ladies of her rank did not choose to be stared at by strangers. And I was obliged to take my leave, though with sincere regret, for the little lord had just squeezed himself into an attitude, than which I never saw anything more ludicrous in General Tom Thumb. When the ladies of the Seraglio come to that bazaar with their cortege of infernal black eunuchs, strangers are told to move on briskly. I saw a bevy of about 8 of these, with their aides-de-camp, but they were wrapped up, and looked just as vulgar and ugly as the other women, and were not, I suppose, of the most beautiful sort. The poor devils are allowed to come out, half a dozen times in the year, to spend their little wretched allowance of pocket money in purchasing trinkets and tobacco, All the rest of the time they pursue the beautiful duties of their existence in the walls of the sacred harem. Though strangers are not allowed to see the interior of the cage in which these birds of paradise are confined, yet many parts of the seraglio are free to the curiosity of visitors who choose to drop. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.